I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The top kill is now scheduled for Wednesday. That's when BP officials now say they'll try to cap with mud and cement that gushing well 5,000 feet deep in the Gulf. But BP's chief executive Tony Hayward warned his staff in an email on Friday it might not work. And after more than a month of failing to plug the well and with oil now coating marsh grasses and sea life, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal is threatening to take matters into our own hands. And Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said yesterday that the government is prepared to push BP out of the way. Jeffrey Ball of the Wall Street Journal is in Galliano in Lafourche Parish, Louisiana. And Jeff, you're writing today that this blowout is revealing how everyone is learning as they go, despite concerns before this well was even drilled. But give us some examples.
Well, that's right, Robin. The federal government acknowledges that there is not enough of this plastic piping that's known as boom that's laid across the coastline in an attempt to keep the oil away from very fragile marshes, and that's something that the nation was not prepared for. There are maps that the federal government uses to assess which areas are the most environmentally fragile, and those maps are out of date, the federal government says. There's been quite a lot of discussion about oil potentially collecting underwater, and there have been research vessels that have gone out to try to take a look at that. One thing, though, that the researchers say is that the results themselves are at this point of questionable value because the bottles that were used to send down into the water to pick up oil in the water were not designed to collect oil. The problem is when you use these bottles to collect oil in water, the oil sticks to the bottles and potentially skews the results. And then just another example is a large question, a large series of questions being asked about these chemicals that are known as dispersants.
And Jeff, we know the EPA is looking into that. A lot of people like marine biologist Sylvia Earle saying these are going to cause more problems or as many problems as the oil itself. Is there a question as to whether or not they'll be banned?
Well, the EPA and BP are locked in basically an impasse over what to do about dispersants. The EPA authorizes generally the use of a number of dispersants on oil spills, and the authorities down here chose one of them, called Corexit 9500, to use in large part on this spill. The EPA, a little over a week ago, then authorized a special kind of application of that dispersant at the subsea well. But then, last week, the EPA essentially switched course and said that it had real concerns about the potential toxicity of that chemical. So the EPA at that point told BP that BP had to come up with what the EPA said was a less toxic alternative. And that brought us to yesterday when the deadline occurred and BP couldn't come up with anything else. And they're now past the deadline, and we will see later today what the EPA says to BP about what BP can do. But the concern among a lot of people is that if this dispersant ceases to be used, a lot more oil may wash up on shore.
Well, there's been political fallout about all of this, questions about whether the Obama administration has let BP handle all of this for far too long. But then you also have Rand Paul, the Tea Party candidate for the Kentucky U.S. Senate seat, who said that the White House has been too hard on BP. But in Louisiana, you have Governor Bobby Jindal, also a Republican. What is he saying?
Well, look, bottom line here is that people in government at all levels are coming to see this as a real potential political liability. And, I mean, just from the local level here, you have some of the parishes, as they're known in Louisiana, proposing to beef up barrier islands in a frantic attempt to keep the oil away. And federal agencies have said that they have real environmental questions about that. And those sorts of questions are angering the local officials even more.
And one of the questions is whether or not you can afford to put sand out on these sand berms, because a loss of sand is a big problem down on those barrier islands. And the fear is that the oil will just wash over the berms, and so you lose the sand and get the oil. But that's one of the debates.
That's right. And then, as you mentioned, Governor Bobby Jindal is expressing increasing frustration here. And then, you know, on the federal level, the head of the EPA and the head of the Interior Department are both in Louisiana today. And it's pretty evident that the federal government does not want to be seen as lackadaisical here, and in its rhetoric, at least, is cranking things up against BP. The question, though, is what the government can do in a technical sense to expedite things. What they've said is that it's BP who has the technical expertise on what to do to try to stop this well from flowing, and absent the well stopping, it's not clear what the federal officials can do on what's really the biggest environmental question with this bill right now.
That's Jeffrey Ball of the Wall Street Journal in Lafourche Parish, Louisiana. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as summer approaches, we want to take a look today at a controversial claim about sun exposure and vitamin D. Now, sun hitting the skin helps the body naturally produce vitamin D, and Boston University professor Michael Hollick says that the overzealous use of sunscreens in the past few decades has led to a crisis of vitamin D deficiency, producing cancers and other illnesses. So he's recommending moderate, unprotected sun exposure. And that has dermatologists up in arms, especially since he also recommends tanning beds for those who can't get enough real sunlight. We're going to hear from Dr. Hollick in a few minutes, but first, Dr. Daryl Riegel, a past president of the American Academy of Dermatology and editor of Cancer of the Skin, a leading dermatology textbook. Dr. Riegel, the official Academy position is that there essentially is no safe amount of sun exposure without protection, and that people should take vitamin D supplements. So your broad thoughts first on Dr. Hollick's call for more sun.
Well, I think everybody agrees that it's important to have good vitamin D levels, but I guess one of the issues we have in dermatology is that we see what the problem is with too much sun exposure and ultraviolet exposure. 1 in 5 Americans are getting skin cancer right now. There's more skin cancer than all other cancers combined in the United States, and there's no reason to intentionally bake in the sun.
Dr. Hollick agrees with you on that. He says, I want to make it very clear, he doesn't advocate burning. He recommends you only get enough sun exposure to establish and maintain healthy vitamin D levels. And there's all sorts of charts and graphs, but he says basically in the spring, he recommends 15 to 30 minutes of sun on your arms and legs, never on your face, 2 to 3 times a week. You disagree?
Why intentionally expose yourself? You're going to get incidental exposure just walking in and out of your car, to the bank, to the supermarket, to all these other things. And you can supplement with vitamin D pills. Why put yourself at risk?
But he says that the problem is that many dermatologists advocate no sun at all so that people have lathered themselves with blocks and aren't getting their vitamin D.
Well, actually, that's not true. We believe in using common sense. There's plenty of good benefits for being outdoors. Where we disagree is that he has published that people should intentionally expose themselves to unprotected sun several times a week. And there's absolutely no reason to do that.
Well, as we said, Dr. Hollick says he doesn't advocate burning. In fact, his goal is to get people to get a little bit of sun more than they do now so that they don't burn. Do you disagree with that, by the way, that a little layer of a suntan, a sort of one that you've planned on, is healthier for the skin so that you don't find yourself caught in the sun and get the burn that is pretty much thought to be one of the causes of cancer?
Burn is not the only cause of cancer, okay? Chronic sun exposure is the cause of skin cancer. Burn is the extreme of chronic skin exposure. So the reality is that there is no such thing as a safe tan. There's plenty of great benefits of being outdoors, but you got to use common sense when you're outside. The vast majority of skin cancers occur on this chronically sun-exposed areas. 1/3 of all skin cancers on the entire body occur on the nose. So wear protective clothing. Wear a hat. It's not hard to do. Try to avoid the sun's rays in the middle of the day when they're the strongest. And whatever you do, don't go to a tanning salon. Dr. Hollick in his books has advocated go to a tanning salon for vitamin D. The reality is that tanning salons are the worst possible place to go because, on number one, the rays of tanning beds are anywhere from 10 to 15 times stronger than they are in natural sunlight. That's why you tan faster. But the wavelengths in tanning beds aren't even the optimal ones to make you convert your vitamin D in the skin to its usable form. So you're kind of not being very efficient by going to a tanning bed, and you're putting yourself at remarkably greater risk for skin cancer.
Thank you, Dr. Riegel. Daryl Riegel, past president of the American Academy of Dermatology, editor of the medical textbook Cancer of the Skin. Okay, that's some of the debate, including, as we just heard, criticism that tanning beds only use the deeper burning UVA waves as opposed to the UVB waves that even help the skin produce vitamin D. Michael Hollick, by the way, says tanning beds have improved, but let's bring him in to respond to all of the criticism. His new book is The Vitamin D Solution, a 3-step strategy to cure our most common health problem. He joins us with more. Dr. Hollick, please outline first, what's the crisis as you see it with vitamin D?
Well, the results are pretty clear. Vitamin D deficiency is the most common medical condition in the world. A recent study showed in the United States that if you compare the vitamin D status of children and adults from 1994 to 2004, there's a 20% increase in vitamin D deficiency. There are three major causes. One is increased sun protection, the second is obesity, and the third is due to decrease in milk consumption. We know now that children 1 to 5 years of age, 50% are deficient or insufficient. Children 6 to 11 years of age, 70% deficient or insufficient. 50 million teens in the United States deficient or insufficient. And why you should care? Because we now know for those teens, they have a 2.4-fold higher risk of having high blood pressure, 2.5-fold increased risk of having high blood sugar, 4-fold increased risk of having type 2 diabetes.
And we know that vitamin D deficiencies in older people and women can lead to bone loss, osteoporosis. What other adult illnesses are you concerned about?
Well, also, there's this bone disease, osteomalacia, which physicians have forgotten about. And basically, it causes aches and pains in your bones and muscles. And often, these patients are misdiagnosed as having fibromyalgia. But also, vitamin D deficiency has been linked to increased risk of prostate, colon, breast cancer, increased risk of having a heart attack. If you have a heart attack and you're deficient, you're more likely to die of that heart attack. 33% higher risk of having type 2 diabetes, marked increased risk of having upper respiratory tract infections, and increased risk of autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and Crohn's disease.
Well, but set that against Dr. Riegel's concern about a huge increase in skin cancer. It sounds as if you're saying there's sort of a risk-benefit analysis going on here, and it's very scary to ask people to take that risk, you know, to expose themselves to more sun when they've been warned against skin cancer.
Well, in the vitamin D solution, I have tables at the end, and I tell people anywhere on the globe, any time of the year, for any skin type, how much sensible sun exposure they can have to satisfy their vitamin D requirement. The amount that I recommend is not likely to significantly increase risk of skin cancer. Most skin cancers are non-melanoma skin cancer, easy to detect, easy to treat, mainly on the face and on the top of your hands.
But as we just heard the dermatologist say, we don't even really think about how often we are out in the sun. Now, you have said it really does on average break down to just maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes, three times a week on average, you know, on unprotected skin, arms and legs in the sun. But his concern is that people don't really understand that they're doing that anyway. So you're going to be adding to sun exposure.
Well, in fact, they don't do that. That's the problem, because parents are paranoid about sending their child outside without a sunscreen. You put a sunscreen on with a sun protection factor of 30, reduces your ability to make vitamin D in your skin by 95%.
And Dr. Hollick, you say never get sun on your face, but you also seem to question if there isn't another cause of skin cancer. For instance, you say many melanomas, the most dangerous skin cancers, occur where the sun doesn't reach us?
Most melanomas occur on the least sun-exposed areas, published in Journal of Investigative Dermatology by Dr. Kennedy.
In fact, you say people who tend to work outside and be in the sun a lot aren't maybe as at risk because they've, what, built up a defense?
There was a study done in San Diego where they looked at Navy personnel that worked indoors and compared to Navy personnel that worked outdoors, and surprisingly, Navy personnel that worked indoors were at higher risk for developing melanoma. If you're getting sensible sun exposure, your body is tanning, and as a result, you're not as likely to get a sunburn. In fact, it's been argued that it often is the lawyer and the entrepreneur who only is going out on their yacht on the weekend getting a sunburn. They're the ones that are at higher risk for developing melanoma.
And by the way, you say, don't misinterpret what you're saying. You are completely against getting a burn. You're against people laying out and roasting and tanning.
No question about it, and I urge sun protection. And clothing, wearing a broad-rimmed hat, is probably your best choice.
Well, what about your advice that people use tanning beds? if they can't get sun any other way. This has been perhaps the most provocative. In fact, you were fired by the head of the Boston University Dermatology Department because she felt that you'd received funding from the nonprofit arm of the Indoor Tanning Association.
So I use a relatively small amount of my entire research budget is coming from the UV Foundation, and it's mainly to fund my research on vitamin D and cancer.
Yeah, but are those people using the tanning beds getting great vitamin D levels and getting skin cancer?
Well, they may be getting non-melanoma skin cancer, and it would be principally on their face, and like I said, easy to detect and easy to treat. But what if, in fact, it decreases their risk of breast cancer by 50%, colon cancer, prostate cancer by 50%, reduces risk of heart attack later in life by 50%? I don't advocate tanning. But also, you should be aware, there's 10 million people out there that have fat malabsorption syndromes. They can't absorb dietary vitamin D. And I often can recommend to them, go to a tanning salon, go in for 50% of the time recommended for tanning, and always put sun protection on your face. You'll instantly make a lot of vitamin D, satisfy your requirement, and not damage your skin in a significant way.
By the way, you also say the tanning beds are not all equal, and some are far better than others. So you say you have to be a good consumer.
Yeah, most tanning beds now have what's called a UVB and a UVA component mimicking sunlight. If you're only exposed to UVA, you can wind up getting a significant burn.
That's because you explained that the UVA is the deeper penetrating ray. The UVB is the one that causes the surface skin burn. So it was screened out by early tanning companies and sunscreens. But UVB is also the ray that helps the skin produce vitamin D. So you'd say, first of all, if you want to get the good effects of the sun, make sure you're getting UVB. But if you want blackout, make sure you block out both.
Always wear sunscreen with UVB and UVA protection because that's been the problem. And we think that that may be one of the causes for the increased melanoma because 20 years ago, there was only sunscreens that absorbed UVB. As a result, UVA continued to blast your skin.
Why is exposure to sun better than a supplement or food? Why can't you just take the supplement?
I have no problem with people taking a supplement. But in my opinion, it's unrealistic to think that every child and adult in the world is going to take a supplement every day. It's just not going to happen. We know that adults need at least 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. And I personally take a supplement every day of 2,000 units. And I drink 3 glasses of milk, which is 300 units. And I take a multivitamin, 400 units. So I'm getting about 3,000 units a day.
Can't you get too much vitamin D?
You certainly can, but you would have to take more than 10,000 units of vitamin D a day for more than half a year to even begin to worry about it.
So you say not everyone can take the pill. But if you can, why not cut your risks and stay out of the sun?
When you make vitamin D in your skin, it lasts 2 to 3 times longer in your body than when you take it as a pill.
You talk about some of the problems related with the deficiency of vitamin D, but what are the good consequences of having healthy levels of vitamin D? As a grad student, I believe, you and a fellow grad student researcher were able to get someone up out of a wheelchair and walk because of vitamin D. Have I got that right?
Well, I identified the active form of vitamin D made by your kidneys. And we recognized that the reason that kidney failure patients had bone disease and couldn't respond to vitamin D was because they could not activate it. So the chemical that we made, the active vitamin D that we gave them, restored their calcium and their bone health. And when they were wheelchair bound, they started walking again.
You know, this just, it tends to take on a feeling of, you know, hyperbole, you know, too good to be true, too much assigned to one vitamin, which isn't, by the way, even a vitamin, as you tell us, it's a hormone. But is it too?
I know.
You know,
there's a lot of skeptics, and I can understand the skepticism because it was first vitamin A, and then it was selenium, and it was vitamin E, and all of them have gone down the tubes. But every tissue and cell in your body has a vitamin D receptor. It's estimated that 2,000 genes in your body, 1/6 of the human genome, is directly or indirectly controlled by vitamin D. It's well documented in literature. We've done it as well. Vitamin D regulates cell growth. It reduces risk of malignancy. There was a study done in Japan just this past year. Children, school children getting 1,200 units of vitamin D a day from December through March reduced their risk of getting influenza A infection by 50% compared to the children that were not getting a vitamin D supplement.
That is the author of The Vitamin D Solution, a 3-step strategy to cure our most common health problems. Dr. Michael Hollick, again, we recommend people talk to their doctors about all of this, but thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Funeral services are being held today for two West Memphis, Arkansas police officers killed in a shootout last Thursday. Authorities say officers Bill Evans and Brandon Powdert were gunned down by Jerry Ralph Kane Jr. and his 16-year-old son Joseph after the officers stopped their van. Then Kane and his son were both killed in the subsequent gun battle with police, who, according to reports, were familiar with the family. Father Jerry Ralph Kane had a history of disputes with authorities tracing back to his time in Springfield, Ohio. In fact, Kane's run-ins with police caused the local sheriff there to warn area law enforcement to be wary of him. Mark Potok is director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, was Jerry Ralph Kane on your radar?
He was not. The movement that he came out of, the so-called Sovereign Citizens Movement, of course, very much was on our radar, but Kane was unknown to us.
Tell us about this Sovereign Citizens Movement.
This is a very strange movement that goes back to the late 70s, early 80s. Essentially, what these people all believe is that the government has no right to tax us. Most laws, including criminal laws, do not apply to American citizens. That the government cannot do things like force you to have a driver's license or register your car. And it is precisely those last two things that often gets people in this movement into extreme trouble with police.
Well, we know that Jerry Ralph Kane was jailed in New Mexico last month. He was pulled over, didn't have a valid driver's license. He also traveled the country giving classes in something called redemption foreclosure mortgage fraud. What does that mean to you?
The redemption is really a scam, and it's the idea that you can get back all kinds of money. In other words, you can get back taxes that you paid the government. And in this particular iteration, what Jerry Kane was selling was the idea that one could reclaim one's foreclosed home for pennies on the dollar, if anything at all. All these theories are based in, they're completely groundless. There's no basis at all in the law. But people like Jerry Kane will go around the country and sell these ideas.
So people actually pay hundreds of dollars to go to these seminars. And it's part of something, you know, as you said, called redemption theory, which we understand generally sees the federal government as an evil entity involved in conspiracy theories aimed at ordinary Americans. And you write, the best-known version of redemption theory claims that every U.S. citizen is a straw man. What do you mean by that?
Their idea essentially boils down to the thought that when you are born, the government puts a certain amount of money into a secret account and that you can reclaim that money. You know, this relates to all kinds of strange ideas they have. Sovereign citizens often say that if a judge or court official uses their name, they can demand millions of dollars because they copyright their own name.
But, Mark, the question is, how many people believe this? One of the disturbing things that jumped out at us after the incident on Thursday was that the car, the van that Kane was driving, was registered to an address in Ohio, a place called House of God's Prayer. The New York Times says that this is the home of an aging white supremacist. But that 100 more vehicles were registered to that address.
First of all, tens of thousands of people literally believe in sovereign citizens theory and redemption theory and so on. The van that was being driven by Jerry Kane and his son was registered to a very particular address in New Vienna, Ohio. This, for many years, was the headquarters, the Ohio headquarters of a neo-Nazi group called the Aryan Nations. At the time that it was active, Aryan Nations in Ohio was headed by a guy named Red Redfern, who actually tried to murder a police officer in the early 90s. Redfern is dead, but the property is still owned by a man named Hogue Tabor, who has been a Klansman for better than 40 years. Exactly what the relationship of the property was to the van and to the Canes is hard to say, but obviously he was allowing people to use the property as a place to register their vehicles.
Well, and I'm sure now there's going to be an investigation into the 100 other vehicles registered at that one property.
That's right. The whole thing is a very interesting and curious kind of scam.
Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, on new information about Jerry Ralph Kane and his son Joseph, both of them killed in a shootout with police last week. Mark, thanks as always.
Take care.
Okay, up next, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan on the race to the top, teacher tenure, seniority, charter schools. It's all in 30 seconds, here and now. Could the Obama administration's education agenda end up radically changing the benefits teachers have enjoyed for decades? That's the question at the heart of yesterday's New York Times Sunday Magazine piece, The Teachers Union's Last Stand. It was reported by Steve Brill. It detailed the Education Department's Race to the Top program, in which states compete for $4 billion in federal education money and are rated on several criteria, with the highest number of points awarded to states that commit to eliminating seniority-based compensation and permanent job security or tenure. We spoke last week with Education Secretary Arne Duncan about all of that and his support for a separate $23 billion education and jobs bill, which he says has to pass, or 300,000 teachers will lose their jobs in the next school year.
Well, what we're trying to do here is avert an education catastrophe, and we have to educate our way to a better economy. We all have to work together, and I am very concerned, very worried about class size going from 25 to 40, about summer school being eliminated, particularly for disadvantaged children. We see extracurriculars disappearing, art and band and music and debate and sports and PE.
Mr. Secretary, I have to just jump in to say those things are gone. Arts and music programs are pretty long gone.
Well, in too many places, that's correct. And what we don't want to see is to see, again, hundreds of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of educators laid off. And I'm very, very thankful for Senator Harkin's leadership, Chairman Miller, Congressman Obie working together on a $23 billion emergency jobs package to keep educators in the classroom.
Well, that might be an immediate fix, but is it just a short-term fix? What about the long-term? Economist Josh Barrow of the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research wrote in Forbes recently that teacher pensions are underfunded by $1 trillion. So should we do something about, you know, this long-term fiscal health before giving money that, again, is just going to run out again and be needed again?
Obviously, there are long-term challenges we all need to work on and do that as well. But at the same time, what we can't see happen is this fall, this September, to see class size skyrocket to go to four-day weeks, children who desperately need summer school this summer being denied those kinds of opportunities. We have to close the achievement gap. We have to give every child a chance to be successful. And so we need to deal with this crisis right now.
Why do you think it is that schools are just so impoverished? I mean, you and I went to school at a time when we had all those things that are either being cut or cut now. What do you think it is?
Well, this is obviously the toughest economy we've seen in a long, long time.
But this has been going on for a decade.
Well, it may have been going on for decades, but it is dramatically worse today than at any time in decades. But while we think about and work on the long-term fixes, which you're so right about, we need to prevent this catastrophe, and we need to do that now.
Well, I ask the question, you know, why do you think it is? Because a lot of people blame teachers. They say that it's teachers' costs, those teachers' pensions, teachers' benefits. In fact, you rate states' applications for this race to the top funding that we spoke about, this idea that if states get to certain point averages, they can have a piece of this $4 billion in federal aid. And the most points, 138, come from eliminating seniority-based compensation and permanent job security or tenure. Now, these are the most important things to teachers' unions. What are you saying? Are you saying that that's the problem?
No, that's not what we're saying at all. And I think anyone who blames teachers fundamentally doesn't understand this issue. I think we have to do, as a country, a much better job of supporting teachers, of recognizing excellence, of rewarding those phenomenal teachers that are making a difference. If teachers, after great support and mentoring, simply aren't making it, yes, we need to have those honest conversations and move them on. But the vast majority of teachers are doing a great, great job, often in very tough circumstances.
We saw articles recently about the young crop of teachers coming up and they can't get jobs. And the way you hear teachers vilified, you wonder if people will stop choosing to go into that field. But some teachers' unions feel betrayed by you. This goes back to a story that we saw unfold here in New England. I'm sure you remember it. All the teachers and administrators at Central Falls High School in Rhode Island were fired under another program, a federal program, that gives federal aid to the worst performing schools if they do certain things. Now, since then, the Central Falls School District has gotten all the concessions it wanted from teachers, concessions like extending the school day by 25 minutes, requiring teachers to spend an hour a week tutoring students and to eat lunch with students once a week. So they're not going to be fired. But you sided with Central Falls. The teachers got angry. You couple that with the other program, the Race to the Top, that encourages people to eliminate seniority-based compensation and tenure. Teachers, you know, you may be saying, as you just did, how much you support teachers, but many aren't feeling it.
Well, we actually worked very, very hard in the Central Falls case to get that resolved, and that got to a great place. And I promise you what's going to happen for children at that school this fall will be much better than what happened in the past. The fact of the matter is they have a dropout rate greater than 50%. They had a very small percent of students reading or doing math, I forget which one, at grade level, only 7% of students. And so that's a place where we have to challenge the status quo as we do around the country. But what the right remedy is, what the right solution will never be determined by us, will always be determined at the local level.
But I think the bottom line is teachers want to know. So let's hear from you. Is your main goal to bust unions?
Of course not. That's the silliest thing ever. I have a great, great working relationship with both unions. I spent a tremendous amount of my time literally every day working with national leaders, working with local leaders, and the unions are actually part of the reform effort. So I think, you know, the media loves to try and create controversy. We have much more areas of agreement than we do disagreement.
Do you want to get rid of tenure?
What we want to do is we want to have meaningful ways to get there and to have meaningful evaluation. You know, you talk to both national leaders, AFT and NEA, and they will tell you that teacher evaluation is broken. I was at a school in Prince George's County, very, very diverse population. The vast majority of students live below the poverty line. Lots of potential excuses for low performance. They've seen student achievement skyrocket. They've done it by rewarding excellence. It's been a great partnership between the union, the teachers, the principal, the superintendent, every parents, everybody working together for the past couple years with real courage.
One last question, Secretary Duncan. You're a big proponent of charter schools. You were in Chicago. These are schools that are publicly funded but privately run. But there's that Stanford University study that found that fewer than a fifth of these schools do better than standard public schools. A half offered maybe an equivalent education, but a third offered a significantly worse education. So are you rethinking this, that, you know, maybe the money that pours into charter schools that sometimes get adopted by celebrities and others maybe should be redirected to the standard schools?
I've been very, very clear again, and you can check all my speeches on my record. I've been absolutely consistent. What I've said is I'm not a fan of charter schools. I'm a fan of good charter schools, and we just need more good schools in this country. Where charter schools are getting great results, we need more of those. Where charter schools are part of the problem, we need to close them down. I spoke before the National Convention of Charter Schools and told them exactly that.
Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education. Thanks so much, Mr. Secretary, for speaking with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Have a good day now.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. But before we go today, did Fox TV's 24 give American troops permission to torture? That's in 1 minute, here and now. It's been a rough couple of days for fans of groundbreaking TV shows. Last night, Lost came to a close. What was that about? And tonight, after 8 seasons, the hit Fox TV show 24 ends.
The following takes place between 12 p.m. and 1 p.m.
Every season of 24 added up to 24 hours, a full day. So every year was actually a day in the life of Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland, a special agent with the government's fictional counterterrorism unit, or CTU. Every episode, a heart-thumping race against time. Jack Bauer uncovering plots, thwarting terrorist attacks, often using torture.
Where's my wife and daughter?
Where is the bomb?
Where's the bomb?
Tell me where the bomb is!
Where are the locator codes?
Where is the override device?
You tell me where the missile's headed.
I want to know who the shooter was.
I want to know who ordered it. I want names. Now!
Did you hear what I said? That's Jack Bauer. He's coming for me.
When does that man eat or go to the men's room? Stephen Keslowitz is a lawyer and, while executive editor of the Law Review at Cardozo Law School at Yeshiva University, he wrote about 24 and the law. He also published a book, The Tao of Jack Bauer, and joins us from NPR in New York. Stephen, the show is a big hit, but people were skeptical early on.
Yeah, I had recently read that some of the actors, even Kiefer Sutherland, didn't think the show would work because he said it might be too smart and just too different, the real-time format, the political issues. It's a controversial show in some ways, and you know, it's obviously been very successful.
Well, let's get to some of the controversy first. A lot of criticism, especially from the military. Remind us, the dean of West Point actually went to speak to the producers.
That's right, and they actually requested that Kiefer Sutherland come to West Point and speak to cadets because they feared that soldiers would torture prisoners in Iraq. And in Iraq, they actually found sets of 24 DVDs.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Diane Beaver said Jack Bauer was hugely popular at Gitmo, gave people there ideas. Right-wing talkers like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck love Jack Bauer. Here's radio talk show host Laura Ingraham on Fox talking to Bill O'Reilly.
The average American out there loves the show 24, okay? They love Jack Bauer. They love 24. In my mind, that's as close to a national referendum that it's okay to use tough tactics against high-level al-Qaeda operatives as we're going to get.
So did the show address this criticism?
During season 7, the show did address torture, I think, in a different way. Here we saw Jack being more reflective about torture. And although he still did the same things, you could tell that he, I don't know if the right word is regret, but he certainly thought about it a lot more. They started that season with Jack in front of the Senate committee, and I think he was unrepentant at that point, but as the season went on, we saw a different side of Jack.
Well, let's listen to a little of Jack Bauer's fictional Senate testimony before a subcommittee about his use of torture as an agent of CTU.
Mr. Bauer, who is Ibrahim Haddad?
He was a member of a terrorist sleeper cell CTU had under surveillance in 2002.
And isn't it true that you detained Mr. Haddad without due process and that you used extreme interrogation methods on him until he answered your questions?
Yes, sir.
Did you torture Mr. Haddad?
According to the definition set forth by the Geneva Convention, yes, I did. Ibrahim Haddad had targeted a bus carrying 45 people, 10 of which were children. The truth, Senator, is I stopped that attack from happening.
By torturing Mr. Haddad?
By doing what I deemed necessary to protect innocent lives.
So, Stephen Keslowitz, Jack Bauer sort of became the person who launched the question, what would you do if you knew a terrorist had a bomb, you know, and you had to get the information? Even people like former President Bill Clinton, you know, ruminated out loud about that on Meet the Press. You know, gee, what would you do if you're the Jack Bauer person?
Right, exactly. And what's interesting is that 24, and I make this argument in my book, it brought torture to the mainstream in one sense in that it's now on television. It's not confined to policy debates or legal debates. And now people's main source for these arguments that we've been discussing is 24. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But when you do see Justice Scalia and Bill Clinton and, you know, presidential candidates quoting Jack, it's worth mention. I do think that the show is crafted very carefully, but at the same time, you wouldn't want 24 to influence the way law is formed.
Well, you mentioned Justice Scalia. The Supreme Court justice said, Jack Bauer saved Los Angeles. He saved thousands of lives. Is any jury going to convict Jack Bauer? I don't think so, which is, and as you say, kind of scary considering that he was a rogue agent.
Right. And Jack is willing to accept the consequences of his actions. And this is actually what Bill Clinton was talking about. He basically said that the president should distance himself from actions of rogue agents and let Jack Bauer go before his peers. And this is what actually Jack had argued in that Senate hearing. Jack had said, look, I have no problem letting the people that you represent, who the senator represents, decide what should happen to me. Just like Scalia said, it's sort of the people's decision.
Well, Stephen, how do you think the whole thing's going to end? There is going to be a movie, so we can't, right. He can't exit the stage entirely, but what do you think happens tonight?
I did hear that there's going to be a very big confrontation between Chloe and Jack. She is a computer analyst, and they just forged this great friendship over the years. And now she's sort of going against Jack. She thinks he's kind of gone mad and has to track him down. So I think he hasn't completely snapped yet. He's still getting information. He's still kind of having an operation. But the show is darker. I don't think things are going to end well for him. Maybe he'll be imprisoned somewhere abroad. Maybe Russians will capture him, and the president, continuing the cover-up, won't say anything.
How much are you going to miss him?
I'm going to miss him a lot. my family and girlfriend, all we do is talk about 24 on Monday nights, and it's been a passion of mine. It's been exciting, and it's a great way to learn. I think it's a great way to begin to understand issues like torture and terrorism and politics. And even though it's a fictional show and you have to sort of get past the point that Jack Bauer, if there was anybody like Jack Bauer, he would have been dead years ago. Yeah, I'll miss him. I think Monday nights are going to be different.
And of course, as you've said, there might be some, in the military in particular, breathing a sigh of relief that he's gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly people in the military did take this very seriously. You know, Michael Chertoff, the former Homeland Security Director, said that he praised 24 for its reflection of real life. And that's actually a quote. Ted Kennedy, who was very liberal in his final days before he died, he reportedly was watching 24 DVDs. And then, of course, John McCain actually had a cameo on the show for a few seconds. He is a huge fan of Jack Bauer in 24, and, you know, he says Jack and he differ on the issue of torture. So I think the message behind 24 is that not one political viewpoint is correct. I think it's just that we do live in a dangerous world. It's not as dangerous as the world in 24, thankfully, but it really does teach people a lot of lessons, you know, the necessity of torture, the evils of torture. And if we actively have discussions like this and engage the debate, I think America and the world is better for it.
Stephen Keslowitz, a lawyer and author of the book The Tao of Jack Bauer, waiting with great anticipation for tonight's series finale of the Fox TV show 24. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.